Welcome to The Lion's Den, brought to you by The Bluebird. On today's episode, we speak to Louise Shanahan, a middle distance runner who has won a European youth title representing Ireland. Louise is also studying a physics PhD at Trinity College, Cambridge. Okay, so joining me today is Louise Shanahan. Louise is originally from Cork in Ireland, and she is a second year physics PhD in Trinity College. Louise is a middle distance runner, having represented her country at youth level. She was in 2013, she was the 800 meters European youth champion. And in March 2020, she won the Irish national indoor champions at 1500 meters. So I understand you are one of the few who managed to get back to Cambridge in advance of this lockdown. In terms of you running at the moment and trying to keep up some semblance of training, how are you managing in a very empty and quiet Cambridge, I'm sure?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a bit patchy. On Tuesday, it was snowing here, or at least there was ice all over the floor. And I found myself running down the back of Eddington, being watched by bin men, trying to find the least icy bit of path that I can. It's really quiet here in Cambridge. And it's nice, I guess, that we can still run in pairs. So there's kind of a little bit of a social aspect to it. But yeah, it's really quiet. The city is dead. And yeah.
So in terms of, obviously, it must be difficult because you can't get the level of training, or maybe the amount of training with coaching or whatever at the moment that you would normally have. But even given that, so we mentioned your success both at youth and senior level, both representing Ireland and in the nationals there. I should say as well, you were the 2020 800 meter Bucks indoor winner, and you were also part of the successful cross country varsity team for Cambridge last year. What is the next big, obviously we don't know, varsity is a difficult question to ask because every sport hasn't a clue at this stage. Some might claim to have plans, but I think we can all admit that those are patchy at best. But in terms of your own personal career, what is next on your horizon? What is the next event that you have an eye on?
Yeah, so before COVID, the big goal for this year was to go to the World Student Games in China. Who knows if they're going to take place? So I think at the moment it's kind of, we don't really have goalposts. I think that's what makes training quite difficult at the moment, is we don't know when the next race is going to be. And sometimes it seems like it might only be 2 or 3 weeks away, and then all of a sudden we might not race for the rest of the year. So I think at the moment I'm just kind of focusing on getting as much training in as possible so that I can run as quick as possible if and when races present in the summer. So hopefully we'll have major championships next summer, but we'll have to see, I guess.
And so when in the summer, if it takes place, will these university games be happening?
So these are in August, so they're after the Olympics. So hopefully, maybe a little later in the summer, they might be more likely to take place. But we'll see. It's difficult when you have to bring athletes together from all across the world.
Of course. And forgive my ignorance here, but to those of us who are probably a little bit guilty of, paying attention to athletics when the Olympics and the Worlds are on, these student games work? How does it work in terms of representation? Are you representing the university? Are you representing your country?
So it's kind of weird. So you do represent your country. So I'd be running for Ireland rather than Great Britain. But I think you represent your country through your university. So my university would now be the University of Cambridge in Great Britain, but representing Ireland as a nation. So it is actually done through the nations that you would represent, say for normal major championships like Worlds or Olympics or Europeans.
Okay, so you'll still be wearing Irish stash.
Yeah, that's the plan.
That's the most important thing, obviously. We mentioned earlier your background and how you are originally from Cork, in the south of Ireland. I might be able to make a comment on you've done well to lose the thick Cork accent since coming to Cambridge, and I'm certainly the same. Being from Dublin, I've been accused of the same thing. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about that transition, about that move, because you went to University College Cork originally for your undergrad, and obviously you came over here to Cambridge for your PhD. Reading up about you, I know that change led to a lot of change in your running career in terms of, your training regime and coaching structures and things like that. So I was wondering if you could shed a little bit of light about that process, about how at the age of what you would have been, about 22 after finishing your degree, all of a sudden having quite a big shift in your career running wise.
Yeah, so Cork's not that small a city, but I kind of feel like a small city girl now that I'm here. And I kind of had a really good structure since I was pretty much 9 years old. So my father is my coach at home. And so that makes things really easy. I see him all the time. And then I would have had great strength and conditioning and great physiotherapy and everything, and just a really kind of sound structure that I had at home, say, kind of from when I was nine, kind of progressing more as I got older. And then all of a sudden I moved to Cambridge, and I don't really like the idea of remote coaching, so I quite like my coach to be there and to see how the sessions are going. And so I kind of talked to my dad, and it was very clear kind of that, you know, when I went to Cambridge that I would be coached by someone else. So all of a sudden I was looking for a new coach, a new physio, new strength and conditioning setup and everything. Which was, I guess, just a completely new change for me. I was quite lucky, and that as part of my undergraduate, I spent a year in the University of California, Berkeley. So as part of that, I trained with their NCAA Division I team. So I kind of had an experience before of just kind of a complete move of my life, and having new coaches and, say, not being coached by my father. So that definitely helped with the transition. But I think the biggest thing with the transition was both the university cross country team, so the Hare and Hounds, and UCAP, and the sports scholarship program here in Cambridge. So I think it must have been the Easter before I arrived here, I got in contact with Phil, who's the cross country coach, and we talked, and we actually met at races over the summer. And I knew kind of I'm a fast athlete, a speed athlete. I like doing the short stuff. And I knew that the endurance side of my training was something I really wanted to develop. So this was kind of an opportunity to do that. And then, so I kind of had the coaching and the running setup sorted when I came to Cambridge. But the rest of it, I had no idea what I was going to do. I was still in contact with my strength and conditioning coach from home and my physio and stuff. And I knew I had to kind of transition over, but didn't really know what the plan was. And that's where UCAP came in, and they've just been so supportive. So they kind of offer strength and conditioning, nutrition, sports psychology, physiotherapy. So that's really helpful, and actually is almost a step up on what I was doing beforehand. So I have the sports psychologist now, which I didn't have at home. So it was definitely a big shift, but it was also an opportunity, and it worked out quite well. So I'm delighted.
You mentioned your dad there, and that's something quite interesting because obviously there's quite a lot of examples of high profile athletes who are coached by their parents. I mean, the example that popped into my head is Lewis Hamilton, the F1 driver, and how he kind of acrimoniously parted ways with his dad at some point. Obviously this you changing coaches from your dad obviously doesn't sound like it was in any way acrimonious, but it must be difficult no matter what the circumstances, and no matter how maybe it was impossible in any scenario for him to stay on as a coach, how difficult was it to have that conversation with him that he'd no longer be your main coach?
I think it was actually quite easy for me because my dad knows me quite well as an athlete, and I'm definitely someone who kind of needs their hand to be held during sessions. So I'm kind of good at not finishing sessions. So I have a habit of running the first rep way too hard, blowing up and being unable to finish a session. And as an athlete like that, it's quite hard to kind of plan my training in advance because I'll go and do something stupid and ruin the session in the first 2 or 3 minutes, which doesn't help anyone. So it really works for me to have a coach that's present. And okay, ideally I wouldn't do that, but if I do that, then they can kind of adjust and kind of work on the spot. So we've known that for a very long time that I'm the kind of athlete who needs that. So for example, when I went over to California, it was never a question. There was no way that, you know, my dad can definitely, he knows me really well. He knows me probably better than anyone. But he can kind of give advice and kind of say, oh, well, actually, have you considered this? Or you do realize your volume's increased or something like that. So he definitely still has an input, and that's really helpful. But I guess there was no way he could coach me kind of from Ireland when I was in California. And that was kind of a good practice run, I guess. And the same thing coming over here in Cambridge, at least we're in the same time zone here. But there was no way that, you know, he was going to be coaching me from a distance. But it works quite well now. So for example, when I go home, I'm still in contact with Phil, but my dad will be at all the sessions. So for me, a coach is kind of two things. One, it's the person who sets your sessions, but actually that's kind of the easy bit. Someone said to me recently that coaching is easy. You just take a small number and a big number. So for example, 3 and 10, and you either do 3 by 10 minutes or 10 by 3 minutes. And so there is more to coaching than that, but kind of the session of sessions isn't actually the hard part. It's kind of learning how the athlete responds to that, how they're getting on, knowing when to push them and knowing when to pull back. And that kind of, you do need a present coach, or I believe you need a present coach to do that. And so it works quite well. I'd still consider my father as my coach, but I'd also consider Philadel as my coach and several other people. And I guess my coaching structure is kind of growing, and I now have a full setup in Ireland and a full setup in the UK. But yeah, we didn't have a difficult conversation at all. And this was kind of always how it was going to happen. And yeah, he's still at home coaching, so he's there whenever I go back.
Yeah, that sounds like it sounds like a very personal dynamic, and therefore you need to be very close to your coaches. And obviously, your father being your coach, there's obviously going to be quite a close relationship there. We mentioned earlier on in the intro how your national 1500 meter indoor title is the same as what he won twice back in the 80s. How much of a, I guess, first of all, was that something you were aware of before that particular race, thinking it would be quite cool to do? And then secondly, once you did it, I mean, how much did that mean to both you and him that you both share the same title?
So I knew that my father had won national indoor titles at 1500, but to be honest, the only reason I ran the 1500 last year was because, so I'm naturally an 800 meter runner and I'm trying to work on my endurance, as I was saying. So part of that was running more 1500s. And so I decided, look, there aren't that many races in the indoor season, I decided to do the 800 for Bucks. So I thought, okay, I'll do the 1500 for Nationals. And it was only after the race that all the people kind of were saying that. And I must say, my immediate response kind of was, oh, well, he won two of them, so I'm going to have to win it next year as well. But actually, the Nationals has been cancelled this year due to COVID. So that's kind of out of my control. But yeah, I knew definitely that he had success and that he had national titles, but I don't think I was super aware of it when I was standing on the start line, to be honest. I'm not a 1500 meter runner. And so when I was standing on the start line, I was more worried about getting dropped in the opening couple of laps, or the amount of laps that I had to run, or losing count of the laps, than kind of winning the race.
And what about afterwards? So you say it was kind of other people that had told you, but once other people did tell you that, that must have been quite a nice moment between you two to have that, or was it purely that competitive aspect that you mentioned, you just wanted to equal him?
No, it was fantastic. So this is my first national senior title. I never thought I'd win it over 1500 instead of 800, but that was just a wonderful day. It was just before kind of things shut down for the pandemic, and there's a really nice photo of myself and dad together at the track afterwards, and yeah, it was just a wonderful day, and probably one of my favorite races now. Which is, considering it's the 1500, is a little surprising.
And which of the two, so obviously you might have surprised yourself by winning the 1500 when you say, as you say, you're mainly remaining 800 meter runner. Which of the two are you targeting for August for the games in China, should they go ahead?
So I'm definitely targeting the 800 meters. I think as I grow older, I'm going to kind of drift out more towards 1500. And over the last 2 years, I've got a lot stronger. And I think I went from being a 4:30 to 4:18 1500 meter runner last year, and there's plenty more to come off that. So I do think that kind of long term, I will progress to being a 1500 meter runner, but my heart is really in the 800 at the moment. And so I'm going to stick with that as long as I can.
Of course, by all means. You mentioned there your times, and I noticed that, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but was at some point at a meet last August, you dropped your PB in the 800. I have it written down here as 2:03:17. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, so I ran two 800 meter PBs last year, and so I came into the season with kind of a 2:04 high PB, and then we were just trying to find races, and at the end of the summer in August, and an opportunity presented to race in Belfast, which worked out really well for me for non-running reasons, because I could travel to Belfast and not quarantine and race, but my parents could drive up from Cork and they wouldn't have to quarantine either. So it kind of presented an opportunity to us because I hadn't seen them in a couple of months at that stage, having been landed and living with them for 4 months, which was unexpected as well. So we were able to both travel, or all of us travel to Belfast, and kind of see each other for a weekend and also do this race. And I was in quite good shape. I mean, I trained quite hard throughout the lockdown, but I picked up an Achilles injury when I transitioned to track. So having had all the tracks closed for most of the first lockdown, I found that when I came on the track here in Cambridge that my Achilles kind of tightened up. So I didn't actually have any kind of like racing specific training. I was doing a lot of aqua jogging and making friends with the lifeguards and things like that, but not actually kind of looking to not being able to race. But I did want to go over to Belfast to see my parents. And yeah, I ran, I think I took a second off my PB, so I ran 203 high, which was a massive shock to Phil, my father, and myself, and kind of showed me that actually training is overrated. And then I came back here, and maybe 10 days later, I took another half a second off the PB. So yeah, so for quite a short season, it was quite successful and very unexpected. So I was delighted.
Yeah, that's really interesting actually. You speak about maybe that means training is overrated a bit. How close in terms of the qualifying standard for the student games, where is that? So that number, the 203 low, where is that in terms of what you need to be running in order to get over to China?
So the previous qualifying standard has been kind of 204 low to 204 mid. So technically that would mean I've run it twice. But one of the problems is because it was the pandemic, the races were structured a little different. So we had male pacemakers. So it was a race which was all girls, but one male would pace the race. And because there was a male pacemaker in both races, both of those times are actually like unofficial or can't qualify me for major championships. So I did run a 204.37, I think. After that with a female pacemaker, so that one will count. But yeah, it just depends where the standard ends up, whether kind of they could set it in between my like official times and my unofficial times. But yeah, I know I ran those times last year, and to be honest, I think I'm in better shape now. So hopefully, if given the opportunity to race, getting those qualification standards and I guess officially getting them shouldn't be too difficult. But we'll have to see. The standards haven't officially been set yet, so there's no point really worrying about it now. It could be nice instead of this 204.4 and make my life a lot easier.
Yeah, of course. I mean, by all means, it sounds like, regardless of the pacemakers, I mean, if you're running that time, you're clearly able to be well within that qualification standard. You mentioned that if you know, if let's say they do set it at the higher end and you need to run that time again or a lower time than the 204 to get in, when are those opportunities likely to present themselves? Or is that a completely redundant question because nobody knows what's going on at the moment with all these with races?
So I was hoping to race this indoor season, and hopefully qualify for the European indoors. But unfortunately, people aren't that keen to have people travel from Britain to mainland Europe at the moment, and there hasn't really been the racing opportunities in Britain. So as a result, I think it's unlikely that I will get a race on this side of Easter. But hopefully, kind of in maybe end of April, early May, the races should start to come. A lot of people are kind of saying, will we have any races next summer? But to be honest, last summer we still had 6 weeks of racing. So I kind of think worst case scenario, we'll end up with the same thing, and hopefully that would be enough. But I guess if we only end up with 6 weeks of racing, it's unlikely the major championships will even go ahead. So I guess we'll worry about that in the future. It's kind of hard to guess now.
I mean, the attitude is at the moment, at least the external attitude that major race organizers are giving through the media, and obviously I'm speaking about Tokyo here, is that it's kind of like come hell or high water. These things are going ahead, but is that sustainable? Like you said, if you only get what 6 weeks of serious preparation, or not, I'm not just talking about the Olympics here, I'm talking about general high level competition. Are attitudes like that realistic or fair on the athletes?
I think it's interesting. I think it's a really different kind of game to what we normally play. So normally you know when your races are. You know months in advance. You've plenty of time to prepare for them, and things are very controllable. And as a result, you can really gear your training towards races. I think if the Olympics were to go ahead, it would be really interesting to kind of try to predict who is going to win, because we don't know. People don't have races beforehand. I've discovered kind of over the past 2 years that actually I'm an athlete that doesn't need a lot of kind of training to get sharp, and kind of doing a lot of winter work. I only need kind of 3 to 6 weeks to really get into track shape. But there's other athletes who kind of need a lot more than that. And it's quite difficult without, you know, for example, I was supposed to be racing in London last weekend. And I think on the Wednesday night, the meet got cancelled. And it's really hard to kind of work on those timescales. But I do think people are doing a wonderful job at trying to give us these opportunities. And some of the races we had last summer, you know, it was individuals who put in a lot of work to get us to the start line. And I'm really, really grateful for that. But it's just different. It's not that, you know, it's the best that we can do at the moment. But it's just really different to the kind of normal control preparation that we have. And it'll be really interesting to see what athletes kind of step up to the mark with this kind of unpredictable nature, and what athletes kind of just don't. And part of that is not even kind of the athletes or their attitudes or their fault. It's kind of how their body responds and how quickly they can get into race shape and kind of prepare for races. So it'll definitely be interesting what happens, whatever it is.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. You make that point. But it sounds like you personally thrive in situations like this with a little bit of uncertainty, like you said, because it takes you only, like you said, 3 to 6 weeks to get into track shape. And obviously you compared that with other athletes who maybe need slightly more ongoing training regimes. Do you have any idea why that is? Like, is that a physical difference? Or, you know, I suppose if you did know, then it would make your training a lot easier.
So I think some of it is physical. So I think I would always consider myself kind of a fast athlete. I like a sprint finish. And I generally don't have to work too much on my speed work. So that probably is the key thing, is that, you know, because my speed comes naturally to me, it takes kind of a lot less time for me to get to race shape. Whereas, say, an athlete who's a lot stronger, but maybe speed isn't quite as natural, will need more event-specific kind of track work, and that may not be available. So again, that's not really the athlete's fault that it kind of works out that way. But I think, yeah, I think the other thing is, it's kind of like mentally, it's quite refreshing when, okay, it's quite stressful to not know when your next race is, or to have things cancelled or different things going on. But it's also, you kind of just have to laugh at sometimes and like just laugh it off that, like, okay, yeah, this got cancelled, or this, you know, we tried to run on the track and all of a sudden it's closed because of some announcement that was made last night. And I think it kind of mentally, it requires you to be quite robust, but then also you can just say, well, actually there's so much bigger picture going on here than just me, and kind of it's sport, and at the end of the day, like, yes, we take it seriously, but it's quite fun as well. And I think definitely last summer there was kind of, I mean, the only times I left Cambridge was to race, so it was really exciting when we kind of got to go, say, to London to race. It was like the biggest thing that's happened this week or whatever. So I think it was kind of nice and refreshing as well. And I think mentally it's just a different game as well. So yeah, but it's quite different for different athletes, and we all have different facilities and conditions to work with. So
of course, yeah, but from your own personal point of view, it sounds like you've got quite a good perspective on everything. And you know, we hear a lot about the difficulties everybody has during lockdown and during COVID times mentally, and the lockdown fatigue and the mental health issues that this is causing in all walks of life, not just in sport, but obviously athletes, and the uncertainty of their competition can be something that's quite difficult to deal with. It sounds like, you know, you said you all you can do is laugh when something is cancelled last minute. It sounds like you're dealing with things quite well. How much is that, do you think, down to the fact that you have another priority in your life, that being quite an important PhD?
Yeah, so I think that really helps. So it's funny that you say that I kind of have a good attitude about it. I think some of the people around me would kind of laugh at that and say,
oh, really?
Oh, well, you haven't met her then. But yeah, I think it's it really helps kind of who I surround myself with. And kind of there are some people who are quite negative about it and just kind of trying to kind of keep people positive. But for me, it's quite refreshing to have the PhD. And so I like to play kind of a little trick on myself, and where if I'm running and running doesn't go so well, I tell myself, oh, well, you know, you're a physicist, so actually this is kind of just a thing you do on the side. And then if I'm doing physics and say physics doesn't go so well, then I say, oh, this doesn't actually matter. You know, you're an athlete, and this is just kind of the day job. And I think that's kind of, for me, it works quite well because it means if one part of my life kind of falls apart, then I can kind of just switch mentally to the other side of it. And it kind of, I haven't quite had the situation yet where like running and physics goes horribly wrong. I'm not sure how I'll deal with that. But yeah, at the moment it works really well because it just means that when things go wrong, and they do quite regularly, that there's only so long I can kind of be down about it because I can focus on the other side and kind of have a good day, at least using the other side. So
yeah, it sounds like you've got a really good balance there between the two and juggling them as well, which I'm sure brings with it its own challenges. But like that mental trick you talk about sounds really interesting, a really interesting way of dealing with it. Is it a 4-year PhD? Is that the timeline?
Yeah, I've been here for 4 years.
Okay, so you're nearly halfway through that then, if this is your second year. In terms of that trick, telling yourself one day you're a physicist and another day you're an athlete, where it's impossible really to talk about maybe 2 years down the line, because who knows what the world is going to look like in 2 years. But what side of that, you know, binary do you see yourself falling on, if either, after completing a PhD?
Yeah, so I think this has been something that's been quite interesting for me. So I had the option to do just to run in America for my undergraduate. And that would have been really cool. But I thought, okay, well, actually, that's putting all my eggs in one basket. And you know, running can go wrong. I learned actually as soon as I sat my leaving cert, which is the equivalent of the A-levels here in the UK, I broke my foot, so I broke my navicular, and kind of had running taken away from me, and discovered actually, you know, it can go in just a second. It was a fluke race. I kicked and I broke my foot, which is quite strange. And kicked means like to accelerate rapidly rather than like physically kicking someone, before people think I'm too violent. But yeah, so I think I learned that, you know, things can be taken away from you, and not to put all your eggs in one basket. So kind of from that point on, I very much look to have the two things in my life. So I would like, when I finish my PhD, will be there'll be a year and a half technically left in an Olympic cycle. So I would like to focus on athletics for that time. But I think I would definitely need to have something else. Now that something else doesn't have to be physics, but most likely will be something like that. But I definitely think that I need the second thing, because I mean, training goes badly, you know, things don't go as planned. And it is really nice to kind of have the other side of my life to kind of switch to and kind of distract myself. So yeah, I think like long term, I'm aware that athletics is not a career, kind of, that maybe some sports have the privilege that they can kind of make a income from it and long term stick with it, but that's not really a thing in athletics. So I would like to kind of take a year or two to prioritize athletics, but then long term the game will be physics.
Okay, so it sounds like whenever this is my fault for not knowing this, but if they stick to the, I don't know, I mean, you might know this, the answer to this, whether the Olympics after Tokyo, whether that sticks to a four-year gap, or do they keep that as if the Olympics were in 2020? So right now is the thought process that the next Olympics will be 2024 rather than 2025?
Yeah, so I'm not exactly sure, but my thoughts were that the only time the Olympics has stopped that I know of has been in the World Wars, and then they continued on their cycle, so they basically just missed Olympics. So they've never like delayed Olympics as far as I've known. So this is kind of unprecedented. I definitely haven't heard anything about, say, Paris 2025 or LA 2029 yet. So I would assume that they're going to go back to their normal cycle. But maybe a lot of that depends on whether Tokyo actually takes place this summer. So I guess we'll see. But at the moment, I'm planning for 2024.
So you're working on the assumption that what you're going to be finished this PhD sometime in 2023, is that correct? And then all guns blazing potentially for the year after. That's really exciting. And in terms of that Olympic ambition, I mean, again, to go back to your CV, you know, 2013 youth champion, and then I think I'm correct in saying that you made the final again in the same competition the following year. So clearly, you were quite a successful youth athlete, something which must have brought its own pressures, because at the end of the day, it's easy to forget that when you're on these in these international tournaments and representing your country, you are a teenager. You know, you are incredibly young, and then every country in the world is guilty of this, but Ireland no less, because it is so rare that we have you know, these young athletes who are so talented and have the can give this the country this hope of going on and achieving senior success. I mean, talk to me a little bit about the pressure that was put on you at such a young age, once you started having these successes.
Yeah, so I think I don't think that anyone kind of pushed kind of excess pressure on me at the time. I think it was more a case that I put a lot of pressure on myself. So for example, I had won the Europeans. Well, you know, I expect to win next year. And kind of I put a lot of pressure on myself kind of daily. So every session had to go right because this was what I was aiming for. So I don't think it was a case that kind of there was a huge amount of external pressure, or at least compared to the pressure I was putting on myself, it wasn't as significant. But yeah, I mean, I kind of there was a year or two where I was the cover girl for different, you know, for Athletics Ireland and local track meets and things like that, and picking up awards, and kind of I lived what looked probably like kind of the dream to kind of 13 or 14-year-old athletes. So yeah, so I went through that and that was fun while it lasted. But I think the toughest part for me was actually after that. So I broke my navicular in 2015, so just after I finished my leaving cert. And that was kind of the start of kind of maybe a plateau. So I had won the Europeans in 2013 and ran, I think, 208 for the 800, which was a big PB at the time and possibly a European lead. And then the following year, I went and I qualified for the final of the World Youth Olympics. So again, that was kind of a step up. My time didn't improve, so I still ran 208, but I kind of still felt like I was achieving things. And then I went and broke my navicular and still ran 208. So I broke 208 and yeah, I ran 208 and broke my navicular. The following year, I kind of had 6 weeks training trying to qualify for the World Juniors because I had been injured for most of the year from the previous summer. So I managed to qualify for the World Juniors, still ran 208. The year after, I think I went over to America and trained in Berkeley, still ran 208. Then the next summer, I came back from America and still ran 208. And I think over these kind of, I think maybe 6 or 7 years in a row where kind of I plateaued. And I think that was probably the toughest time for me. Because everyone who was kind of telling me how great I was when I was 14 or 15 years old kind of faded into the distance and kind of forgot about me, which I mean that was fine, but actually I think what was the toughest part was kind of hearing constantly that, oh well, you know, you don't want to be successful when you're a youth, it's when a senior that really counts. And it was almost like the success I'd had previously was negative rather than a positive. And I hear it now a lot, kind of people looking back and saying, oh well, this person ran really well as a youth, but do you hear them now? And actually, okay, you mightn't be hearing about them, but that doesn't mean that they're not showing up for training every day. And kind of, I remember someone telling me, oh, I didn't know you still ran. And well, yes, I pretty much run every day for the past, I don't know, 10 years. So I think probably the toughest part wasn't actually kind of being in the limelight when I was younger. It was kind of not even falling out of the limelight, but actually kind of the negative press that I was getting, which was kind of, oh well, she overtrained when she was 14 or 15, and you know she won't make it to senior athletics. And I think that was kind of the toughest part for me, because if you hear it often enough, you'll believe it. And I think I would have really struggled to kind of talk about this maybe 3 or 4 years ago when I was kind of still at that plateau. But over the last 2 years, I've kind of really developed as an athlete and I've kind of come through it. And now I hear about how people describe kind of other athletes who are still in that plateau. And I think that's where we really need to protect our athletes, because a lot of girls run quite fast, you know, when they're younger, and then kind of plateau kind of from 17 to 21, that kind of style. Some people only do it for a year or two. I did it for 6. But it is really tough. And those are the years I think that you kind of really lose, the girls lose interest in the sport. And it's, you know, it's tough enough to kind of turn up for training, especially in Ireland where it's raining most of the time. But if on the other side people are kind of saying, oh well, you know, you overtrained when you were 14 or 15, and you know, you kind of ruined your hopes for the seniors, your senior career. You know, what I did when I was 14 or 15 was pretty impressive. It's still, I'm still really proud of it. I don't think I did anything kind of wrong. I got injured, and most athletes get injured at some point. But I came back, but yeah, I think that what we really need to do is not so much kind of, I don't think we should necessarily play down kind of when youths are successful. I think that should be celebrated. I mean, the youth competition is kind of, there's athletes, there's still all the countries in Europe competing. So it is still really impressive to do kind of achieve things at youth level. But just to be careful of the athletes when they come out the other side, because people do hit this plateau, and just to protect them, and not even just not to talk negatively about them, because it's impossible for everyone who, if we talk loads about kind of, oh, well, you know, you don't have to be successful as a youth, you can develop into a senior successful athlete. You know, there are people who are going to be successful as youths and won't develop into successful senior athletes just naturally, kind of no fault to the, of their own. But there are also athletes who will be successful youths and will struggle for a few years and will come back as successful senior athletes. And I think we kind of need to protect athletes if they have been successful, and not to talk negatively about their achievements and kind of compare them to their past self, because you know, 14 or 15-year-old me was really impressive, but you know, current me is also impressive and kind of working hard. And also in those years where I had plateaued, I was working just as hard. So it's kind of, yeah, I just feel we need to protect the athletes during those kind of years. They're quite vulnerable then.
Yeah, and obviously you are embodiment, you know, the what as good an embodiment as it can get of coming out to the side of that plateau. I mean, you know, 203 last summer was obviously a significant improvement from that 208 plateau you kept that you kept hitting. It sounds like you're advocating for like a shift in attitudes, not necessarily towards youth or senior, but like that gap in the middle of like, you know, what 18 to 20 roughly. Is that a wider conversation that's going on within athletics at the moment?
Yeah, so I think it's quite a wide conversation kind of across the board, looking at the transition from junior to senior athletes. So maybe I hit my plateau a little earlier than some athletes. But I think what we specifically need to look at is girls, because girls change quite a lot during those years. Their bodies change, they need to develop into those bodies. And it's not necessarily a negative thing. And I think there's a lot of conversations going on recently with Reds and kind of accepting these and trying to have as healthy bodies as possible. But the other side of it is just we have to kind of, people can't be, you know, everyone can't be the very best at all times, and people do go through these plateaus. And some of my closest friends were incredibly supportive to me when every race I seemed to run 208 and kind of not improve. But definitely, yeah, I think it's something that we just need to be careful of. We just need to be aware that, you know, there are a lot of athletes going through this at the moment. And at the time, you know, you don't know if you're going to come out. I didn't know if I was ever going to break 208. It kind of seemed like it would be on my gravestone, Louise Shanahan, 800 meters, 208. But yeah, I think we just need to kind of, yeah, open the conversation and talk a little more about how we can protect athletes in these times and kind of be supportive. And I really remember the kind of people who reached out to me during those years and kind of said, oh yeah, I see you turning up at the track, you know, every week you're doing great kind of stuff. And that was really nice. But even if we can't be overly supportive, just not to be negative about it. Because yeah, people are successful as youths, but kind of that doesn't mean that they can't be successful seniors, and it doesn't mean they should kind of be punished for that later on. If they kind of plateau or things don't go as planned.
Yeah, of course. And I guess that lack of support or even negativity, as you say, towards these young female athletes, is that something that you felt or that you feel currently? Is that something that needs to be provided institutionally? So we're talking, you know, the bodies that these athletes run for, or was it more of an issue with external influence and people, like key people who aren't necessarily involved with you every day? So, you know, you talked about winning awards and press talking about you as a youth and things like that. Does the problem come from that side? Is it an institutional problem or is it a bit of both?
So I think the mindset kind of needs to change quite a bit. Because I think what we think of is in athletics, I guess, it's a really cut and dry sport, because you get a time. So, you know, you either run faster or you don't. And maybe in other sports, say like soccer, it's kind of harder to measure. But in athletics, it's really easy to tell if you're better this year than you were last year and so on and so forth. So I think kind of just recognizing that, you know, just because that time doesn't improve doesn't actually mean that the athlete hasn't improved. I think when I ran 208 the first time, it was just the most exciting thing that ever happened. It was kind of a fluke. By the time I was kind of 20, I was doing it in every race, but just not really improve, like running any faster. So I think just kind of taking a step back from the time and actually looking at, oh, well, you know, this athlete has changed quite a lot and they can't be summarized by just one number. Because I know several people who kind of ran quite fast when they were younger and then kind of, you know, 4 years later haven't really improved and they're still trying to break through that barrier. So kind of just supporting athletes and showing them that actually they're more than just that number, and that kind of times aren't the end of the world, and kind of, yes, we do plateau, but you can get through it.
Are those attitudes that in your experience coaches have and display, or is that something that definitely needs to be developed more?
I think it's something that we need to work on, because I was quite horrified a few months ago when I was in a video call and I heard a coach talking negatively about an athlete and using their name, and they were saying, oh, well, you know, they did all this as a youth and, you know, this was wonderful, but look at them, where are they now? And I think it's kind of, the conversation has turned, you know, there was a lot of, there was a time when it was like, oh, you know, just because you're not successful as a youth doesn't mean you can't be successful as a senior. And I completely agree with that. There are loads of people who kind of develop into the sport, and I think that's wonderful. But I think it's almost gone too far at this stage where being successful as a youth, if anything goes wrong after that, the conversation is like, oh, but where are they now? And I mean, you actually don't know because they're not in the press at the moment. You don't know where they are now, but there is a good chance that athlete is turning up to training every day. It's just the cameras aren't on them. So where are they now isn't their fault. It's because you haven't looked into where that athlete actually is now and kind of the work they're doing. And so I think it has come from kind of this idea that athletes kind of that you don't have to be a successful youth to be a successful senior, which I definitely agree with. But I guess just because you were a successful youth isn't a negative for your senior career. I mean, there are some athletes who kind of win Europeans and Worlds from the time they're 15 all the way up to when they're 30, but that's pretty rare. So chances are there will be years where they plateau, and just not to say where are they now, because chances are they're still training, they're still working just as hard, you're just not hearing about it.
Yeah, of course. That's really disheartening to hear that's coming from a coach who's involved with the sport and, you know, frankly should know better, rather than, you know, some reporter who may not have that much of an athletics background coming into it. So it sounds like a really important conversation to have about the attitudes towards runners of that age. And like I said, if anyone is living proof that these attitudes need to change, it's yourself. I mean, you're looking at targeting an Olympics after completing a PhD from Cambridge, for the love of God. I mean, if that's not proof that these plateaus can be shattered in your 20s, then I don't know what is. But yeah, good luck Louise. I hope that, it sounds like you'll have no problem qualifying for the student games in China in August, and, you know, fingers crossed they go ahead. And I'm sure we'll be in touch, you know, later on down the line to hear about how you're getting on with that. And of course it's the, you know, you're finishing your PhD and your career after that is a long way down the line, but I'm sure everybody we'll be wishing you all the best and looking forward to seeing you run in Paris whenever those games take place. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about these really important issues. I'm sure I certainly learned a lot today, and I really hope a lot of our listeners have.
Thank you, it was great fun.
Thank you for listening to The Lion's Den. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow The Bluebird on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to keep up to date with the world of Cambridge sport.